The committee will come to order. Do I have approval for minutes of April 5th, 2016? Representative Pearson moves approval of minutes for April 5th. Any corrections or deletions? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Zerwas, we have before us House File 3048. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 3048 to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before us. I understand there's an A1 amendment, author's amendment. Representative Zerwas, would you like to address that first?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. The A1 author's amendment is an appropriation of $5,000 in the fiscal year 2017 to the Commissioner of Health for the licensure process.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Representative Zerwas, your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 3048 has to do with a pretty difficult topic dealing with hospice services primarily for children. It was over the summer attending an informational seminar put on by Crescent Cove that I first learned about the challenges facing Minnesota families and really families in the U.S. of not really an appropriate place for families to deal with such a really difficult situation. And so what House File 3048 aims to do is help set up with the Department of Health some opportunities for some licensing of some pediatric hospice homes. With that brief interruption, I'll turn over to Katie Lindfelser from Crescent Cove, and she can go into the mission of Crescent Cove.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Welcome to the committee, and please pronounce your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Katie Lindenfelser with Crescent Cove. Our organization is founded in 2009. It's our mission to offer care and support to children and young adults who have a shortened life expectancy and their families. It's our vision to build the first residential children's hospice and respite home here in Minnesota. There are only two homes like this in our country that provide respite care and end-of-life care to children and young adults. One is in Phoenix, Arizona, and the other is in San Leandro, California. The legislation we're proposing will impact our efforts as we work to build this home. Children who stay at the home will have life-threatening conditions or are medically fragile with conditions such as cancer, muscular dystrophy, spinal muscular atrophy, rare heart and lung conditions, genetic conditions, and chromosomal disorders. The home will have 8 rooms for children, 3 family suites so families can stay as well, living and dining spaces, rooms for spiritual care, creative arts, multisensory, and hydrotherapy needs. It's a model that started in the United Kingdom over 30 years ago, where there are now 52 homes. There are 8 across Canada and only 2 in our country, with none here in Minnesota or in the Midwest. We're looking at a site here in St. Paul. In addition to working to build this home, we're providing support services to families now, covering the costs for services to relieve pain, anxiety, and stress. Advocacy is another of our goals as we held our first pediatric palliative care symposium that Representative Zerwas participated in last year, bringing together clinicians, families, and policymakers to advance care for children and families in the Twin Cities. We have collaboration among all the Twin Cities pediatric hospital leaders, Pediatric Palliative Care Coalition of Minnesota, and adult hospice providers. Residential adult hospices are reluctant to take children for the reasons that the care, the diagnosis, and also the medication dosages are very different for children compared to adults. This legislation adjustment is a first step as we look to find avenues for reimbursement for children who stay at this home. There are thousands of families in Minnesota who care for children with a shortened life expectancy. 700 children die each year, and a number of those families are waiting for a home like the one we're working to build. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lindenfelser. Next up, Mr. Tift. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Zachary Tift. I want to thank the chair and representatives. In June of 2004, my then 9-year-old daughter Mariah started on a journey with Ewing sarcoma, a rare form of bone cancer in her right femur, which was removed, replaced with an internal prosthetic, and then followed by chemo and radiation. In July of the following year, she endured the first of many reoccurrences. She battled bone cancer on and off for almost 7 years and passed on May of 2010 at 16 years old. She fought through roughly 70 rounds of chemo, 100 rounds of radiation, major surgeries, the daily ups and downs, far too many nights in the hospitals to count, and carried herself gracefully with gratitude to her God while teaching us along the way the true meaning of living fully so you can die empty. She took the lead on how she was going to die because she knew that we cannot always choose what happens in life, but that we can choose how we go through life and become aware of the inherent blessing if we are all allowed, when we are allowed the opportunity to choose how we're going to die. In discussion about how she wanted to live out her remaining days, however long we had, she wanted a suitable hospice home. She refused to die in the hospital where there are simply too many noises and interruptions. Mariah refused to die at home where her family would be left with the daily reminder of this is the room where Mariah died. I remember the feeling of disbelief we shared when we learned there were no hospice homes for children and young adults in the entire state. Disbelief in a time of disbelief. She said, "What do you mean there are no hospice homes for young people? What does this mean and where do I go?" Mariah had always been helped in environments that serve children and young adults. The aesthetic appeal of environments can affect the children's emotions, and Mariah always appreciated the intentionality of places that had been designed with children and young adults in mind. I know because she'd always point out the things and tell me what she liked and how it made her feel. It didn't make sense to us that we didn't have a hospice home for children. We looked into the availability of various hospice homes around the cities that we were told were very nice, but that insurance didn't cover the cost of hundreds of dollars per day, which we could not afford. We eventually found a hospice home that was specifically designed to serve elders here in St. Paul who accepted Mariah. It was very simple, it turned out to be beautiful, and there was no cost to our family. Staff told us that they thought she was the youngest person to pass away there. After Mariah passed, they also said they probably couldn't allow a young person to pass there again because so many of the staff were affected, as many had children her age. It just hit too close to home for them. I must be clear, the staff were truly incredible. There were some bumps in the road, some nuances we had to figure out together to assist our teenager to die. Issues like privacy. Staff were trained to leave doors open so they could always keep a watchful eye on their elder patients. However, Mariah would ask me to close the door, and after many times, had to talk with each one of the staff on each shift to explain why I or another family member would close the door and always be there to take care of her. The conversations that you have with a teenager are also far different from conversations you have with an octogenarian. So some of those conversations, there was a little bit of uncomfortability, but over time we were able to smooth that out. Staff are also trained to encourage families to be hands-off so staff can take care of the one in hospice, as caretakers are often the adult children who will take care of their elderly parents while also juggling their own family's work and life. And they are often tired, often very stressed, and needed a break, and have needed a break for a long time. However, I wasn't tired at all. I was taking care of my child. I had energy. I did not want nor need a break. This was not an 80-year-old parent. I knew exactly how she could move and how not to move so as not to hurt her. I was hands-on with Mariah and wanted to be, so I had to tell the staff that I and others would also be taking care of her and to politely ask them to sort of back up a little. I don't blame them at all. They were doing their jobs. However, we had to navigate the differences between old and young, and that took time, and our time was limited, so it added even more stress. Lastly, in hospice, one of the benefits is that she got to go wherever she wanted to go, which we did on numerous occasions, unlike a hospital that makes a patient stay on the property. Hospice also let us have a birthday party in there when she turned 16, with a lot of guests and balloons. Also like the hospital, which limits guests and doesn't allow balloons, because at one point they said static, the static from them can cause fire alarms, which we found out the hard way. The point is, after figuring out the ups and downs of how Mariah could pass comfortably, a hospice home built for elders ultimately allowed Mariah and her family to choose how she wanted to be during her sacred time. Let us now do our part to allow respite and hospice for children so they can be together comfortably during their sacred time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tipp, for your testimony and for sharing your daughter's story and that will help other families down the road. We do appreciate you being here to share your story. Any other questions or any other testifiers on this bill? Seeing no other testifiers, any questions? No questions from members. Representative Zerwas, anything else you'd like to add?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd just like to thank Zachary for coming in and talking about Mariah and his journey. And I think it's really hard, if you haven't been there, to understand the challenge of having a young child or a teenager that you're told and you know this is the end. And they don't want the end to be in a hospital with the beeps and the buzzers and the alarms. They don't want the end to be a mom and dad's house where, as a child, you know that as you're sick, it's really impacting your entire family, and everyone is hurt. And so we need another option, and I think this bill is the first step in getting us to that option. And with that, I'll renew my motion.
Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 3048, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. 3048 is re-referred to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and thank you, testifiers. All right. Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to make more noise when I come in next time.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Dabney. We don't often see you in here, so we're looking for you there. House File 2731, welcome to the committee. I will move House File, 2731 be laid over. The bill is before us. Representative Dabney to House File 2731.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate being here. As you say, I don't get here often. I will strive to keep my remarks brief. We have several testifiers here today, and if members look in their packets, there is a large compilation of letters of support from across the state from folks of different perspectives, organizations, school officials, school staff, mental health providers, and even parents whose children have benefited from access to these services provided, SchoolLink mental health services provided, professional therapists in the schools, bringing in a skill set that teachers and administrators don't have, but that students benefit from. And when we talk about access, if you look at the top of the packet that you received is a map. It is in a large number of districts across the state. In fact, 85% of the school districts in the state now are using these grants. That's not 85% of the schools, which is an important distinction here. We want to make this more available to more students because clearly there is need for these services. The grant funds, to be clear on the mechanism for this, it is the community provider working with the school district who applies to the state for the grant. The grant then allows them to place a professional therapist in the schools, provide space in the school for them, they're still allowed to bill back third-party payers for their services, but the grant also covers services to the students, to the staff, and to the family that third-party payers will not pay for. The example that I always think of, having been a classroom teacher, is the therapist can sit down with the staff in the school, with the student's team of teachers and others, and walk through, okay, when little Jimmy makes both hands into little fists, here's a way to help little Jimmy get through that situation and make sure that little Jimmy is handled consistently across the day. It increases little Jimmy's chance of success. It increases little Jimmy's well-being. It increases the opportunity for education, not just for little Jimmy, but for everybody else in the classroom, the better off little Jimmy is. With me today is Sue Aberholden from the National Association of the Mentally Ill in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to hand it over to her.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Aberholden, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And I want to thank you for the opportunity today to talk about the importance and effectiveness of our school-linked mental health program. I work on a wide variety of issues related to the mental health system, and this program, by far, is the most popular. Mental illnesses are a young person's illness. Half of all adults begin experiencing symptoms before the age of 14, and 75% by the age of 26. Our schools see children who have been impacted by the trauma they've experienced, children who simply have not learned to regulate their emotions, and children who have developed a mental illness. All of these children need help, and without it, often do poorly in school and in life. Through this program, we can identify and treat children early, before it becomes serious. Everyone sees the results, from parents to teachers, and thus everyone supports this program and are strong advocates to increasing its funding so that all children who need this help can receive it. In the packet today, you have letters from 10 organizations representing education, health, and mental health, 17 letters from superintendents, principals, special ed directors, 29 letters from schools, from teachers and school support personnel, 8 letters from mental health providers, and 6 letters from parents. And actually, before I left work today, I opened up the mail, and we got one more letter from Bemidji, so I thought I would specifically bring a copy for you. But that's over 70 letters gathered in just a few days' time. Again, its effectiveness in helping children do well and avoid becoming disabled by their mental illnesses. Today, you're going to hear from a wide variety of testifiers who all see the benefits of this program. On behalf of the children and the families we represent, I urge you to support increased funding for this effective program.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholden.
Mr. Chair, there are several other testifiers. I don't know what order you would like to take them in. I'll defer to you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Dear Mr. Chairman, representatives, guests, I am honored to testify today. I am Dr. Mark Sander. I hold a joint staff position with Hennepin County and the Minneapolis Public Schools. And today I am testifying on behalf of Hennepin County, the Minneapolis Public Schools, and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. And we all fully support this proposal. In 2005, I helped develop and implement the school mental health program in 5 schools in Minneapolis. Today, the program is in 40 schools in Minneapolis and over 130 schools across Hennepin County. In 2015, the Center for School Mental Health at the University of Maryland, which is the National Technical Assistance Center for School Mental Health, recognized our program as an exemplar program nationally. The school-linked mental health programs significantly increase access to and engagement in mental health services for students and families. Over 50% of the students receiving services are receiving them for the very first time. And over 40% of those students were found to meet the criteria for a serious emotional disturbance, meaning that they were at risk for being at risk of out-of-home placement in the next year. These programs are able to get students in who were not able to get care for whatever reason previously and had significant mental health concerns. This program from the Minneapolis data is showing significant results. Both parents and teachers are reporting improvement of mental health symptoms, suspensions are decreasing, and we're seeing improvements in attendance. In addition, principals have reported significantly reduced office referrals. We believe there's a significant need to expand this program. There are many schools that do not have this program and want it, and even in schools that have a therapist, they're asking for a second to help meet the needs of some of the mental health needs at their school. This is a cost-effective way to reach students and families that need mental health treatment. In closing, these programs are critical to improve the outcomes for children and families, especially those families who have difficulty accessing community-based care. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, Dr. Sander. We do appreciate your time today. Next up, we have Dave Conrad. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Dave Conrad. I'm a licensed school teacher, principal, and superintendent residing in Hutchinson, Minnesota. New Discoveries Montessori Academy is a public charter school serving approximately 160 preschool through sixth graders within a 35-mile radius of Hutchinson, Minnesota. We have 54 full and part-time staff serving that student population and their families. Currently, 61% of our students qualify for educational benefits. 38% of our students have an individualized education plan. We partner with Greater Minnesota Family Services to provide mental health support for students at New Discoveries in Hutchinson and at Greater Minnesota Shelter Care Program in Wilmer. We have one full-time and one part-time mental health counselor through Greater Minnesota. We partner with Crow River Family Services and DIRT Group to provide skills worker support and mental health services. This support comes both in the school setting and in the home setting. The connection between the school and the home through Crow River Services has been has had a profound impact on the students and families we serve. We partner with Stepping Stone Therapeutic to provide out-of-school and in-school support. We employ one full-time school psychologist. Currently, 19% of our student population are receiving mental health services through in-school collaborative services and or outside sources. An additional 8% of our students have been referred for mental health support and are on a waiting list to be served. Four students in the past 12 months have been served at inpatient mental health facilities. The placements as far away as Grand Forks, North Dakota, have ranged from 3 weeks to 9 months. More of our students than ever are arriving with mental health concerns. Regardless of the source, whether it's trauma, genetic predisposition, fetal issues, whatever, we are building strong relationships with children and families. We're creating a safe place for students and their families to realize success in the classroom. We do not have the resources to serve the overwhelming number of needs represented by the students we serve. As well as we are doing, we don't have the resources to serve all of the needs. Families are referring other families to New Discoveries because of the level of services and the results garnered through our supportive programming and services. We don't advertise that we provide this level of mental health support. One family tells another family who tells another family who tells another family. We are meeting critical mental health needs in a timely fashion. We're providing strong academic support while the students are under our roof. Consistently, our attendance rates are remarkable considering the needs represented by our students. We're consistently at or above 95% attendance rates. Families, teachers, support staff, and administration are grateful for our willingness as an organization to address mental health concerns squarely. To the question, should we make this available in every school, I offer a resounding yes. Our experience supports that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming today. We do appreciate it. Next, we have Luther Heller, Superintendent of Montevideo Public Schools. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Luther Heller, Superintendent of Schools at Montevideo Public Schools. Montevideo Public Schools is a school district of approximately 1,325 students, in grades K through 12. In West Central Minnesota, and Our experience with the school-linked mental health issue is comparable to that of our neighboring district. So I'm here not only on behalf of our district, but also on behalf of our neighboring districts within our region. We've been a long-time participant in a school-linked mental health collaborative with Woodland Centers, located primarily out of Wilmer with a branch office in Montevideo. Over this time, the school district has seen an increase in the level of collaboration and in the delivery of mental health services to our students and in meeting the needs of our students. We have seen successes within the program, but despite the successes, we are seeing that the school-linked mental health collaborative, that the mental health needs of our students are continuing to increase. A part of this is societal, we know. The latest research indicates that approximately 20% of the students in any given classroom are either suffering from mental health issues or are being impacted by mental health issues within their families. Anecdotally, we are seeing the same thing within our students. We're seeing a steady increase in the number of students being served and being referred for services within our district. Currently, we have one full-time equivalent practitioner coming in to supplement the services of our guidance and counseling program. This person is stretched across all four of our attendance centers. Now, despite the fact that spreading this staffing level across our entire district limits the level of service and at times fragments the service that we're providing to students, we are seeing a positive impact in this program amongst students on an individual basis. We're seeing a decrease in symptoms among students who are being served, and we're seeing a decrease in referrals to the office and referrals out of the classroom among these students. That having been said, however, the increased mobility of our student population, the increased needs within the mental health needs of our student population makes it difficult, if not impossible, to sustain the current level of success with this program without expanding the program to be able to serve more students and meet more needs. An increase in funding in school-linked mental health services would allow for the expansion of this program and enhance the ability of our district and other school districts in our area to better meet the mental health needs of their student population. Thank you for your consideration on this, and thank you for your interest in the mental health needs of our student population.
Thank you, Mr. Heller, for coming and sharing your testimony today. We do appreciate it and the good work you do. Next, we have Margaret Sullivan. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Sullivan. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Sullivan. I'm here just to tell you my personal experience with school-based mental health counseling for my daughter. I should have known. There were all the signs, that the red flags they give you, chewing her fingernails till they bled, falling grades, losing friends. A meltdown in class so significant that the staff felt the need to remove her and send her to the school-linked mental health counselor. She had a positive experience there, and I thought, great, she's going to bounce back now. This is just teen stuff. But then one day I saw the cuts on her arm, the careful lines, so I knew that it was more serious. I needed to connect her to a counselor and quickly, but I didn't know who to turn to. How do you ask for a recommendation from a friend? Nobody knows. So it's quite difficult. But then because you've had that one brief experience with the school-linked mental health counselor, I said, well, would you be willing to see her? And she said yes, and it was the best mutual decision we've ever made. So not only were her appointments easily accessible during the school day, so she didn't have to miss school or after school, the school had cleverly situated the room within the clinic, so my daughter, who was hyper-concerned about confidentiality, could go into the clinic, and maybe if her friends saw her going in there, they'd think, oh, it's a sports physical or whatever. You know, it wasn't anything that was noticeable for her. So that was really important to her. And then she was able to develop a really good rapport with this counselor. And I, too, really appreciated how this counselor was able to guide me through the process, share with me concerning news like, your daughter has suicidal ideation. Here's how to keep your house safe. Here's how to work with your daughter. And by the way, she's reassuring me, too, at the same time. You know, she's not at super high risk, but you just need to be cautious. And so that was really great. She was an amazingly skilled and talented person. And during the two-year relationship my daughter had with her, I saw her improve dramatically. She was able to graduate on time. She was able to attend the college of her choice. It's not been a perfect road since then, but but this was a significant help in our lives. I also became aware of the effect that having a school counselor in the building had on the school itself. It was really amazing. She was working with the teachers to inform them of conditions and kind of help them understand different issues for different that students might be experiencing. She started a silver ribbon group at the high school, and which is peer and mental health awareness and peer support type stuff. She gathered a team of staff and parents to host parent education nights. I helped with that. She wrote a grant for an AmeriCorps volunteer who came in and did substance abuse and mental health awareness for kids. And then, you know, the sad part of the story is I talked to a lot of parents, and they feel like this is the best-kept secret ever. And if you actually talk to the schools and the providers, they're saying, well, our caseloads are full by October. So we can't really just say, yeah, we've got the service available, because can't really offer it to everybody. And the schools, some of them just have mental health counselors maybe 2 days a week, and it's not nearly enough. And both my kids have attended urban, racially, and economically diverse schools. I've been pretty involved in the schools, and I've seen firsthand how much these services are needed and how many struggles these kids have. And I just hope that you won't wait as long as I did to give these kids the help and the access they need. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan, for your testimony today. We do appreciate it. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Anybody else? Okay. All right. Seeing no takers, Representative Halverson has the first question. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for bringing this forward. I appreciate the conversations we've been able to have. It seems so often that when you talk about education budgets and healthcare budgets, a lot of the same challenges arise, and that there's a lot of shifting that's going on within these budgets. And we've known for a very long time that our healthcare system, when it comes to crisis mental health services, is very overburdened. There's not a place to take people. So Representative Dabney and I had a conversation about what if you flip that on its head and start on the prevention side. And the expertise that we have here at the table really shows us that prevention works, that these are really important dollars to put toward prevention that can help us on the healthcare side with our healthcare budgeting, make sure that people are getting appropriate care in the appropriate place at the appropriate time. I've talked to way too many providers who tell me that they feel like they only get to treat stage 4 cancer when it comes to mental health. And hearing the parent's story, I think, really illustrates why these dollars are so incredibly important, because we can also relieve our education budgets by reducing the amount of special education services that children may need, reducing the amount of special classroom time that children may need, or additional years of schooling because they have had to be taken out of their classroom settings because they can't achieve like they want to in the classroom, and perhaps not even graduate. So, I mean, go on to count that economic cost of kids not being able to graduate from high school and being in our system long term, or having run-ins with the criminal justice system. The way the dollars, when we don't do prevention, get spread out are real, very, very significant. And this bill, I think, is extremely important. And clearly from my schools are in here. I saw a few letters from my schools in here. The reaction that we're getting from the schools and the parents I think are really important. And if we're hearing that they're not able to treat a whole caseload, or they're maybe only able to treat more serious cases, we need to be sure we have the resources available so that they can identify and prevent really serious issues with mental health and give relief to state budgets across the board. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Halverson. Other questions or comments for Representative Dabney? Representative Dabney, I thank you for bringing this forward, and it's one thing that we have heard a lot about and continue to hear a great deal about is our mental health in general across the state of Minnesota, but particularly for kids and growing problems. And if you had a pediatrician up there today, I would just my question would be, what's going on? You know, is it more diagnosis than it was 15, 20 years ago? Is it different pressures? Is it different demographics? What's going on in the schools? Do you have an idea?
You know, Mr. Chair, thank you. Excellent question. I can only speculate, but I would suggest that families are under increased stress. That is expressing itself in any number of ways. But also, we're in the schools specifically, we're demanding more of kids today than when they demanded of us when you and I were kids. And that may just be a factor here. I can only speculate. But increased stress often creates challenges, particularly for young people who are learning to manage their emotions.
All right. Any final wrap-up, Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I thought as good as the previous testifiers were, and they were, Ms. Sullivan's sharing her daughter's experience hit home a number of the elements that are important to school-linked mental health. One, the demand for services. Their docket is full up by October. Two, the access issue. The fact that her daughter just had to go down the hall and go into the existing clinic and was able to access a professional therapist. Third, I was a classroom teacher for many years. Previous to that, I'd worked through college in part working on adolescent psychiatric units. So some of these kids would intentionally be cycled into my classroom, but I still wasn't a therapist. I still had the full teacher workload. I didn't have the opportunity to put whatever skills I had to work fully for these students. It's the wrong skill set as a teacher. Putting the right skill set of a professional therapist in the building is what we need to do, recognizing that the whole kid comes into school every day, not just the part that's about reading, writing, and arithmetic. Ms. Sullivan also touched a bit on the information issue. You don't just go out and ask other parents, hey, my daughter's cutting herself. Who do you send your daughter to when she does that? The shame and particularly the stigma around mental health is still powerful, and that limits access to information. One of the strengths of school-linked mental health is that it drops the stigma away. I'm not having to leave work, drive to school, pick up my child, and take them to a clinic that says mental health on it. Particularly in smaller towns, the stigma there can be a real barrier where everybody knows your name and your business. Now it's just going down the hall at school. So it's a powerful intervention that is yielding better academic outcomes for kids and better life outcomes and saving money for the system in the long run. It's all good. I appreciate your generous time today, Mr. Chair, and I ask the committee for their support going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And I agree, Ms. Sullivan's testimony was particularly good. And as a dad of teenagers, the question I was going to ask was, you know, it doesn't sound like a really cool thing to do during the day to go seek mental health help, but how that kind of gets handled in a way that kind of has that in mind for teenagers especially or for kids trying to get the help. I appreciated that as well.
You know, Mr. Chair, knowing the school that she's referring to in that Silver Ribbon campaign where there are students involved who have families, members with mental illness, who have mental illness themselves, who are concerned about peers, that Silver Ribbon campaign sets a climate in that school that makes it easier. And that's powerful, and that has bluntly saved lives in that school for 10 or more years now.
Thanks very much, Representative Dabney. With that, 2731 is laid over. Thank you. All right, next up, we have House File 2539, Representative Halverson. Representative Halverson moves House File 2539 be laid over. The bill is before us. Representative Halverson, proceed with your bill in whatever way you like. I don't see any amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, there are no amendments to this bill. I'm bringing this forward, again, in the spirit of prevention, of making sure that we are using dollars in the system most appropriately to ensure good outcomes for people. And in this case, we're talking about people who are in recovery from substance abuse. And we're looking to have an appropriation to fund peer recovery supports. And these are folks who provide non-clinical services to people in the recovery community to help as they rebuild their lives. And we know that addiction takes a terrible toll on our lives and our family, and people can lose everything very, very quickly. And when it comes to rebuilding, it's a hard road. And I will look forward to getting to hear from these testifiers quickly, but somebody actually said something to me when I talked about this bill, somebody who was in recovery, who said, you know, there's an old recovery story about a person who falls in a hole, and all these people come walking by, and I just heard the chuckle because everyone knows this story. And people come walking by looking in the hole at this person in the hole, and some people might say, well, you should have known better than to fall in the hole. You should have been more careful. Or they wring their hands and say, gosh, I don't know what to do to help get you out of the hole. And then the person comes by and jumps in the hole. And now the guy in the hole looks at his buddy and says, what are you doing in here? Now there's two of us down here. And his friend said, I've been down here before. I know the way out. And that's what peer recovery support is about. And so, Mr. Chair, I would like to have my testifiers talk a little bit about this work in action, if I may.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Julia Alexander. I'm staff at Minnesota Recovery Connection, but I'm also a woman in long-term recovery. And what that means for me is I have a sobriety date of August 28, 1992. I started using drugs and alcohol when I was 12 years old, and I got sober 4 months before my 21st birthday. So I've never had a legal drink of alcohol, and yet it nearly ended my life. And I do not say that lightly. As a result of my 23 years of recovery, I'm very present in my life today with my friends, my family, my coworkers. I'm also very engaged in my neighborhood and local communities. I vote, I pay taxes. In my recovery, I've never been to the emergency room, I've never driven under the influence, I've never supplied alcohol to minors, and I have not been arrested. I have a bachelor's degree from the College of St. Catharines, a master's degree from Claremont University, and I also just recently defended my doctoral dissertation for my doctorate a couple of weeks ago, which felt a lot like this, but I'm glad that it's over. I am employed full-time, I volunteer, I'm an avid movie buff, and I have two awesome Australian cattle dogs that my husband and I adopted from rescue over the last couple of years, Gus and Kiki, who we spoil way too much. So why am I telling you this? Why is this important? I don't share this part of my life or these things for any kind of kudos or a pat on the back, nor because I've done anything or continue to do anything remarkable. I tell you this because while the consequences of addiction are very visible, both financially and socially, we rarely see the extensive benefits of long-term recovery. And this is because when we find the care that we need, which also helps us to foster long-term recovery, we by and large become very invisible. In some ways, this is very good, right? We're living our lives, we're being useful, we're productive members of our families and our communities and our societies. But often as a result of this invisibility, people don't know about recovery. They don't know that recovery works, that it's possible, that there's millions of Americans just like me living in long-term recovery. And when I found recovery, I benefited, obviously. So did my family, but so did my community, my city, and my state. My recovery has largely been successful because I have what's called recovery capital, very strong recovery capital, And recovery capital are resources. They can be social, physical, human, cultural, which are necessary to initiate and maintain recovery from drugs, addiction to drugs and alcohol. So my recovery capital is very strong. I was educated in a private high school in the Twin Cities. I began my college education when I got sober. I had access to transportation. I had access to a sober living environment. I was employable, aided by the fact that I didn't have any felonies, which was very lucky. I sought counseling and support from the community, and I'm very, very grateful and lucky to have had a family that's extremely supportive of my recovery. So my opportunities in recovery, and therefore my life, continue to grow because I received the care and support that I needed to address my addiction, and with this care, my recovery capital continued to grow. And this is exactly what peer support does. It helps remove barriers to recovery and helps strengthen and grow people's recovery capital. So I know the despair of addiction, and I know the incredible joy of recovery, and I want everyone who needs it to have that same care and support that I receive so they can have successful recovery. Supporting recovery in the recovery community has a bountiful return on investment, financially and socially. And I know you take the responsibility of these dollars that you're tasked with appropriating very seriously. I urge you to please also take seriously the impact that peer support can have with these funds on individuals, families, communities, and ultimately the overall health and wellness and happiness of all Minnesotans. Because when we recover, everyone benefits. So I want to thank you for your time and consideration. And then I also just have a written testimony from Paul Yerby, who is an individual that has received support services from Minnesota Recovery Connection. You may know he testified at the HHS Reform Committee. He wasn't able to be here today because he got a big promotion and is in training for his new position. So he provided written testimony, which is being handed out. So thanks again for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Alexander, for your testimony and being willing to share your story with us today as we move forward with this bill. Ms. Hunsley?
Thank you, Chair and Representatives. My name is Tiffany Hunsley. I am the founder and executive director of Recovery is Happening, a recovery community organization located in Rochester, Minnesota. I have brought with me today four recipients of our recovery services. Ladies, could you please stand and wave to the committee? Who are all doing well in their recovery today because of the peer support that they received. A few days ago, I answered my phone, and on the other end, a recoveree who was filled with gratitude. "Thank you," she said, "for believing in me. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you." People often ask me why I'm so passionate about what we do at Recovery is Happening, or on a not-so-good day, why I'm still here. The answer is pretty simple. We're doing something different, and we're seeing lives changed. We are seeing stories that had a singular path in one direction being drastically rewritten. At Recovery is Happening, we work alongside each person and address the underlying causes of what brought them to our door. Many who come to Recovery is Happening are programmed out. Many have been through rehab programs, hospitals, prison systems, and some even jails. They know what it's like to feel like a number or to be looked at as a problem to be solved. But who has taken the time to see their humanity? Who has stopped to see beyond their addiction, their diagnosis, their clothes, their tattoos? Who has really cared to know their passion and their dreams? That recovery is happening, we look at the whole person, and we see hope, we see potential. We see a beautiful tapestry of stories, and we partner with each recovery along their journey, and we root for them every step of the way as they discover a new life. Addiction is a growing problem in our country, and we are committed to addressing the need with an innovative peer-to-peer support-based service. We know that everyone has a story to tell. Some are overcoming addictions. Others are finding hope after experiencing some of the traumas and loss that come along with their addiction. We invite each person into our community, valuing and dignifying all of our guests wherever they are on their journey. There are over 23 million Americans in long-term recovery today. Recovery is real, and it's time we start talking about it. Some say we lack willpower, that punishment will make us stop using, that if we really wanted to stop, we would. For years, I felt broken and alone. My solution to my problem turned out to be my biggest problem. I wish someone would have told me that I had a disease that talks to me in my own voice and tells me I'm not sick. The world has seen addiction, but not recovery. And recovery is everywhere. We have a vibrant, compassionate world full of people in recovery. They help me to find my voice. I now use my voice to bring recovery into the light. Stigma only grows in the dark. Together, we can put an end to it through public education and awareness. Today, I am a face and a voice for recovery, to show others that no matter how far down the scale you have gone, nothing is impossible. To show that a woman with felonies, children taken away, homeless and unemployed, can not only recover, but thrive. Today, 11 years later, a shining example of what can happen when we send people to drug court, followed by peer-to-peer support-based services, instead of prison. Today, I am a homeowner, a voter, founder and executive director of Recovery is Happening, a mother of four, and an advocate for recovery. Why? Because it's a disease, not a decision, and we must not sit idly by while injustices abound around us. We have a voice, and we must use it. I will no longer be trapped by my addiction. I am not my illness. I have a name, a history, a story to tell. As many others who are in this process can be helped by this peer-to-peer support-based services. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak today, and I hope that you will all support this peer-to-peer support bill.
Ms. Huntsley, thank you for finding your voice and being able to bring that to us today. You truly are a shining example for recovery and what can be done with that. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, are there any questions for Representative Halverson? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but just again to thank the testifiers. That was incredibly moving and impactful. So just really appreciate your being here, and thank you, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just a comment. The more of this peer support we see around the state of Minnesota, the better off we're going to be. No two ways about it. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Seeing no further questions, Representative Halverson, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say that it makes me smile when we think about the complex issues that we face as a committee and a legislature, and to know that there are things that are so effective and yet so simple in making long-term recovery a possibility for people, and increasing employment and increasing stable housing and increasing family connections. Making all of that possible doesn't just help lives, but it helps our entire state. And I hope that we can see some support for peer recovery in our budget. So I would renew my motion.
All right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. With that, House File 2539 is laid over.
Thank you.
Thank you. House File 3230 is up next. Representative Zerwas. And as he makes his way to the table, Representative Zerwas moves that House File 3230 be laid over. We have the bill before us. Representative Zerwas, when you're ready, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The motion is to have the House File 3230 laid over for possible inclusion. House Bill 3230 is a bill to increase funding to the state's 17 federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs. These organizations serve nearly 175,000 low-income individuals throughout the state. FQHCs have been around for about 50 years through the U.S. In Minnesota. These patient-directed nonprofit organizations serve neighborhoods and towns ranging from Minneapolis's Phillips neighborhood, near north neighborhoods, to rural areas such as Cook and Tower on the Iron Range. At the heart of the FQHC model is community-based accountability. One of the hallmarks of an FQHC is that the majority of their board members must also be patients at the FQHC. Patients determine how best to address the healthcare needs of their communities. Another unique feature of FQHCs are the enabling services they provide. They tend to the whole person and engage them in their services. These services greatly assist or enable patients to access primary care services. Examples of these services include help with transportation, language translation, comprehensive case management, housing, access to healthy and stable food supply, patient education, and outreach. House File 3230 would increase funding to the FQHCs by $1 million per year. As you will learn, the FQHCs will target these funds to further the goals of, number one, better quality outcomes, number two, helping to lower the cost of health care, and number three, enhance the patient experience. With me today are representatives of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers to give you an overview on the FQHC model and the impact of House File 3230.
Right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ginny Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, and we are the member association for the 17 federally qualified health centers in the state of Minnesota. It is our mission to serve all who come to us, and so in that, our patients largely come from very diverse communities, and they also come from communities who are medically underserved and who come and suffer from high rates of both poverty and health disparities. We have a one-pager that kind of explains some of our demographics across the state. We'd like to thank Representative Zerwas very much for chief authoring this piece of legislation, as well as Representatives Halverson and Loeffler, who are supporting this bill as well. For some background, the FQHC appropriation was established in 2007, and per statute, it directs the state's FQHCs to continue, expand, and improve federally qualified health center services to low-income populations. We support this legislation, and I'm here today to really give you an outline of two pieces. One, what are you as legislators receiving as a return on your investment into federally qualified health centers? And two, how would an additional $1 million investment really provide and enhance the services for our patients? To the first question, what are you getting back for your investment into our clinics? Overall, these funds are used in a multitude of different ways that vary across individual health centers per our community-based governing approach. Some recent examples include, in greater Minnesota, really increasing mobile dental services. Right now, there's a waiting list of about 600 patients waiting to receive dental services in Mankato at Open Door Health Center. They're also expanding behavioral health integration with primary medical care and also expanding their care coordination efforts. Here in the metro, several FQHCs are adding additional care coordinator FTEs to drive down the inappropriate use of emergency rooms and also bring down the cost of health care to the system. They're also expanding dental care in the metro as well to nearly 700 patients waiting for dental services. As the basis of this legislative request, our members identified different areas that need additional state support and funding to really help enhance their services further. The results represent a balance that we have to strike as safety net providers between participating in health delivery reform as well as maintaining our 50-year mission of serving underserved populations. And so the results are grouped into four major theme areas: improved data analytics, enhanced care coordination, expanding access to care, and improving and expanding oral health services. The first two, care coordination and data analytics, are examples of what our FQHCs do successfully or need to do successfully to participate fully in health reform. 13 of our 17 FQHCs are participating in DHS's medical assistance demonstration. And from that project and those programs, we've learned that data analytics are key, and we need them to identify high-risk patients to devote care coordination services to. Once we have that patient population identified, to really be able to expand the care coordination as an essential function to drive down the appropriate use of health care. The second, to improving care access and oral health services, are grounded in our 50-year mission of serving the low-income patients in Minnesota. These funds will be invested into enabling services, as Representative Zerwas mentioned earlier, to really help address the social determinants of health of our impacted patients. These include things like transportation and improving health literacy and health education. The second is there is an overwhelming need for oral health services across the state of Minnesota, particularly in greater Minnesota. While this doesn't solve that issue completely, it will greatly assist our FQHCs in expanding services and bringing down those wait times for our patients waiting to receive dental care. With me today is Dr. Jason Fournier from Westside Community Health Services. He's here to give you a ground-level view of how this investment is really impacting his organization's efforts to serve his patients.
Dr. Fournier, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and then give us your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Dr. Jason Fournier. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Westside Community Health Services, and I'm also currently the chairperson for the Government Relations Committee with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. So thank you very much for the opportunity again to speak this afternoon regarding the FQHC appropriations, and more specifically about the impact on the communities that we serve as a group of federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs, and in particular, my experience running the largest FQHC within the state of Minnesota. Westside Community Health Services is located in Metro East. Most of our sites, we have 17 locations in the Metro East. Most of them are in St. Paul. Each year, we serve about 36,000 unique Minnesotans for about 150,000 medical, dental, behavioral health visits. We also have pharmacy services on site and a very comprehensive array of services. The communities we serve and the patients that we serve come from very diverse backgrounds. And in 2015, by way of example, we served, out of the 36,000 individuals that we served, 87% of them were self-reported as coming from a minority background, either racially or ethnically speaking. 98% of all the patients that we served in 2015 had income levels at or below 2 times the federal poverty level. In addition to that, 56% of those 36,000 or so patients that we serve actually are better served in a language other than English. So as clinicians, when we interact with our patients, we need to have to speak the language that they speak or have interpretive services present as well. A lot of our patients come to us with both cultural and linguistic needs that need to be taken into account in terms of the services that we provide. And so when you take a look at the services overall with the 17 sites, we offer services through very large ambulatory care settings, large clinics on the east side of St. Paul, west side of St. Paul, but then we're also in atypical settings. We have clinics that are located at homeless shelters, for example, Dorothy Day Center in downtown St. Paul, Union Gospel Mission. We also go ahead and provide services within domestic violence shelters. We also have a clinic that's co-located within a public housing development. We also have school-based clinics within the high schools within St. Paul. And so what we try to do as a group of community health centers, as FQHCs, is we try to bring services where our patients reside and where they visit, and making that care much more accessible for them. As Jenny mentioned earlier, our overall governance structure is set up so that our patients actually have a voice on our board, and they actually have a controlling voice on our board in terms of input on what those services are. Similar to other FQHCs within the state of Minnesota, my organization targets services to low-income, low-wealth individuals that are in need of access to care for various different reasons. In meeting the needs of the communities we serve, Westside Community Health Services, like so many other FQHCs, has developed models of care that actually address the barriers that confront our patients each and every day. And so we look at setting up our services so that they're co-located, so we'll have mental mental health providers co-located with primary care physicians, and across the hallway are dental providers, or we'll have dental staff embedded with our medical services. On top of that, we'll have pharmacists that are readily available to help with medication needs, as well as go ahead and support the therapeutic needs that our patients have from a very comprehensive perspective. That allows us then to go ahead and actually increase the quality of care, the comprehensive of the care, and also go ahead and improve the well-being of the patients and communities we serve, which is really what it's all about, is enhancing their lives and helping them live healthier. The FQ&T appropriation has provided since 2007 has been a tremendous help to not only my organization, but FQHCs across the state. We've used the money within Westside Community Health Services to expand our integrated behavioral health services. We've also used it to go ahead and increase our medical services. And more recently, we used it to expand our oral health services within our newly constructed Eastside Family Clinic. And more specifically to that end, we were actually very fortunate to secure a federal grant to allow us to build this brand new facility in 2013. But we would have struggled and did struggle with how are we going to go ahead and pay to add dentists and dental hygienists, especially when we have a lot of folks who are dentally uninsured. And so there really isn't a source of revenue coming through. And so fortunately, the FQAT appropriations allowed us to go ahead and expand those services. And the end result of that is we were able to execute an agreement with the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. We have a lot of partners that help us do what we do each and every day. And as a result of that relationship, we now have a precepting dentist and fourth-year dental students that are located within our clinic providing dental care. As a result of this expansion and enhancement of our services, we now serve more than 4,000 additional dental patients each year for well over 10,000 dental visits each year. That's what the FQAC appropriation has been able to get us as a group of community health centers in terms of services. But not only do we take a look at our services from an expansion perspective, but how can we enhance our services by using tools that are becoming more readily available? A good example is of where FQHCs are quite innovative and have been innovated is my organization with 9 other FQHCs within the state here in the metro area partnered to form the first Integrative Health Partnership, or IHP program, which goes ahead and manages a subset of Medicaid patients. Long story short with that, we've been quite successful. My organization went ahead and lowered ED utilization by 22% through the end of the third year, and that has substantial savings that accrue to the state's benefit. The other part of that, though, is what we learned through that process, and there's successes, but there's always a lot of learnings. And so when you take a look at the learnings that we've garnered through participating in that innovative program through the Department of Human Services, what we were able to identify is that there was a much greater need for us to partner with our patients differently and to add care coordination services, and in particular patient navigation and care coordination services that would support people navigating the healthcare delivery system, engage them in preventative services, and then follow-up testing. And so by way of example, last year Westside Community Health Services received a small grant through the American Cancer Society that allowed us to go ahead and increase patient navigation services for colorectal cancer screening. A big issue, if you don't go ahead and get screened early on, you can end up with cancer. And so early detection and treatment is, of course, preferred. What we were able to do with the funding that we received through the American Cancer Society is we were able to add one patient navigator, and we identified over 16,000 of our patients that were in need of engagement. As a result of that small funding, we added a patient navigator who speaks Spanish, Hmong, and English, and that individual then we were able to go ahead and increase our screening rate by over 30% in a little bit over a year, which is significant in terms of how we engage folks. And one of the reasons why I'm providing that as an example is that it demonstrates the ability for us, when provided resources, to engage our patients in their own health a little bit differently. And these are services typically that aren't being reimbursed, care coordination, patient navigation. And one of the things that Westside would use and increase appropriations, if it were to be provided, would be to increase our care coordination capacity to engage and interact with our patients differently and help them live healthier lives as an end result. So with that in mind, I greatly appreciate your consideration of an increase in the FQHC appropriations as put forth by Representative Zerwas. I appreciate Representative Zerwas's writing of the legislation and moving that forward and your consideration, Representatives. Thank you very much
for the
opportunity today.
Thank you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Questions from members. Representative Loeffler. Representative Loeffler.
That happens a lot, right? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Fournier. That was just a great presentation, and I'm really excited about what you're doing with the FQHPs. So I think, and you talked about a lot of comprehensive health care that you're doing, but I didn't hear a couple of things. So you do prenatal care and mammograms? Just curious about those.
Dr. Fournier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we actually provide prenatal care to about 1,300 women each year. We delivered, and there was written testimony that was passed around earlier as well. We deliver about 500 babies at Regents Hospital each year, and we partner with the state of Minnesota through the SAGE program for mammography for those that are uninsured and those that are insured. We have a relationship with the imaging center, both multiple. Regents is one of the ones, CDI is another, so we have multiple.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, any further questions from members? Seeing no one, any final comments, Representative Zerwas?
I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Zerwas renews that House File 3230 be laid over. House File 3230 is laid over. Thank you. And members, we have one more bill for us today, House File 644. As testifiers are shifting around there, I will know that there are a number of testifiers for this bill. We ask that the testifiers who are coming forward for this next bill limit their comments to about 2 minutes to keep us on schedule and focus on the fiscal note, since this is the fiscal committee and that we have had this bill through a number of policy committees already. Members, if we do not finish by 2:30 today, we will recess and come back at about 6:30 or at the call of the chair, and that will be in this room. So with that, Representative Zerwas moves that House File 644 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before us, and I understand that there is an 88-1 amendment, and that's an author's amendment.
I'll go ahead and offer the 88-1.
All right, Representative Zerwas moves the 88-1 amendment. Representative Zerwas, 2-year amendment.
Mr. Chair, the 88-1, get all my amendments up here. The 88-1, this amendment addresses concerns raised by Representative Pinto and adds persons convicted of human trafficking to the list of applicants who would not be allowed to be registered.
All right. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Let's see. No discussion. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I understand the A9 amendment is also an author's amendment. Representative Zerwas?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Zerwas moves the A9 amendment. Representative Zerwas, when you're ready, 2-year amendment.
Yep, the A9 amendment, Mr. Chair and members, allows the Department of Health and the licensing boards to share information on applicants. And I would support the A9 amendment.
Okay, any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, 2-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This has been a long time in working on this. Started last year and moved through one committee last year and several early in this short session up a system of volunteer registration for practitioners of massage and body work that would allow a little bit of help in today's current patchwork system. And so currently, massage licensure is done by each community through community ordinances or for city ordinances. And so one massage therapist could be licensed in one municipality by that city to perform massage and bodywork services. But then if they wanted to work across the street or the other side of the river in another city, they need to follow that city's ordinances and reapply for a new municipal license, resubmit to another background check, pay yet another fee for that municipal licensure. What this allows practitioners to do, if they want to, is participate in voluntary state registration, where they could register once with the state, pay one fee, submit to one background check, they would be issued a certificate of registration, which they could then go to the city, and in lieu of municipal licensure of that individual, they could present proof of state registration and then practice in that city. Most of you are familiar with Massage Envy. I've talked extensively with an individual that owns a Massage Envy establishment in Maple Grove, in Rogers, and one in Blaine. And his challenge is the current system does not allow any flexibility with his employees. And so he cannot have an employee pick up one Saturday a month in the Rogers location without going through the City of Rogers municipal licensure process, resubmitting their credentials, resubmitting proof of passing a background, and paying yet another fee. And so what this would allow is allow that practitioner, if they chose to register once with the state and then work at any of those Massage Envy locations. That's the gist of the bill. I know there's quite a few testifiers and some additional amendments. And so with that, I'll stop now and we can answer questions as we move on.
All right. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. We'll move right into the testifiers. And again, I would ask the testifiers to keep their comments to about 2 minutes and to focus on the fiscal implications of the bill.
I have one testifier. Can we start with her, Mr. Chair?
That'd be great, Representative Zerwas.
All right.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susan Tejan. I am a self-employed massage therapist in St. Paul, and I am the government relations chair for the American Massage Therapy Association. Additionally, I represent a coalition of organizations, practitioners, and schools that support this bill. That association is an alliance for legislation of massage therapy. I want to stress that this is a voluntary registration, and I ask you to support this bill that has been years in the making. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Tejan, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just really quickly, we have in the last few committee hearings had Chief Geiske from the Burnsville Police Department here to testify in favor of the Minnesota of the bill and explain why the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association support this language. Unfortunately, with some business occurring in the city of Burnsville, he was unable to join us today.
Okay, thank you, Representative Zerwas. We're just going to go down the list of testifiers as they are on the agenda and go from there. So first up, we will have Diane Miller. Okay, and everyone should be able to see the agenda and the list of testifiers that we have in that order. So if you want to start making your way down for your testimony, that would be greatly appreciated. Ms. Miller, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself to the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard some great, wonderful stories here today in your committee, and I'm so glad to have you working for us on behalf of all Minnesotans. My name is Diane Miller, and I'm an attorney and director of law and public policy for National Health Freedom Action. I'm also assisting the colleagues at Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project in opposing this bill. I'm also an original co-drafter of Minnesota 146A in 1999 for complementary and alternative health care practitioners, which currently regulates massage and bodywork successfully. Senate File 1310 contains language that would exclusively protect registered practitioners over unregistered Minnesota 146A practitioners when it comes to their relationship with individual city governments and municipalities. The bill does not adequately interface existing law under Minnesota 146A practitioner regulation with a new registration system. If a new law goes forward impacting the sergeant body, we would hope that it would not create bias towards one group over another working in Minnesota. The language of Bill blocks cities from regulating and licensing state registered practitioners regarding their education and background checks, but does not block cities from regulating education and background checks for Minnesota 146A. This will leave the door open for cities wanting to depend on state registration education requirements to block Minnesota 146A practitioners from practicing. This would jeopardize the practices of thousands of small business healing practitioners who are willing to abide by all municipal laws but have no intent on going to special schools or paying the fees for the state registration, or who currently are working under Minnesota 146A in their local municipalities. We are very concerned that without an amendment to properly integrate these two approaches, this bill would do more harm than good for the future of Minnesota consumers and practitioners using all of the complementary and alternative massage and body workers. Also, regarding the inclusion of body work in this bill, body workers, we oppose the inclusion of body work as inappropriate and unnecessary in the massage regulatory model. Massage and body work are two very distinct communities and practices. Regarding what government body would regulate registration of body work, we do not think the nursing board or a massage and body work advisory council are qualified to decide education and competency exams for the broad community of body workers under 146A. There are different types. Some of them I have put in my testimony as acupressure, aromatherapy, cranial sacral therapy, energetic healing practitioners, polarity therapy, forces of heat, cold water, body work massage and massage therapy, mind-body healing practice, qigong, qisage. We work nationally on many bills like this, and we have spent a lot of energy narrowing massage board jurisdictions because they have taken over body work and tried to shut them down. So we support the amendments that we have picked up over here on the table, a number of them that would help integrate these two models of regulation, and we hope that you take your time and make sure that this bill is integrated into existing law for people who use all of the healers in the local communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller, for your testimony. Ms. Tenar.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Tenner, and although I'm an attorney and I support the organization that you just heard from, I'm speaking to you here today just as a consumer. I oppose House File 644 as written, and I respectfully ask that you vote no on the bill or vote to amend the bill, because it does enable municipalities to discriminate against the 146A practitioners in favor of the state registered practitioners. Personally, I've had anywhere from 50 to 75 plus massages in Minnesota in the last 10 to 15 years. Some of those have been in the Twin Cities, some up north, some in greater Minnesota. Some of those have been at spas. Some of those have been in single rented rooms. A few of those have been at the practitioner's homes. And some have been chair massages at malls or even in the atrium of the law school that I went to during finals. And some have also been at Massage Envy. And all of those I've had because I believe in preventative health and because I'm a better worker, employee, citizen, family member, and wife when I feel better. Of those many massages that I've had, some were good and some were not, and some were relaxing and some were very educational. Because the practitioner never stopped talking. If you've had massages, sometimes you encounter that. But of all of those, the best that I've had were from small, independent practitioners whose performance on me and on the clients on their table really impacted whether or not they could keep the lights on, impacted whether or not they could pay the rental space fees. Not the practitioners who are working city to city. Not the practitioners who are picking up a shift here or there at different franchise locations. And those are the practitioners that the proponents are talking about. But the practitioners that I'm talking about and the practitioners I want you to protect are the ones who consider themselves healers, the practitioners who are dedicated to serving the communities in which they live and work. It is those practitioners who are threatened by this bill and who I could find are no longer practicing in the small towns or up north, or who are charging three times as much because they've had to go back to school to meet the state credential if their municipality decided to make what is a voluntary registration mandatory for practitioners in that city. If there is a concern about trafficking or the police force's ability to shut down proliferators of the sex trade, then I'd love to see that bill introduced. I'd love to see a bill introduced that allocates funds, the funds in this bill, to increase the police force in those problem areas. At least that bill would be creating jobs in the name of protecting the health, safety, and welfare, rather than singling out this profession to supposedly serve that end without any proof that a state credential drives down prostitution and other sex crimes, and rather than discriminating or diminishing diversity in this profession without any demonstration of harm from the practitioners practicing under the current system. So please protect the diversity of healers that I can access in the state of Minnesota by voting to oppose this bill or adopt the A-11 or A-12 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tenner. Next up, we have Leo Cashman. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leo Cashman. I'm president of the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. And some of you have been around for a while may recall that we spearheaded the health freedom statute. That's what I like to call it, Chapter 146A, that many thousands of practitioners have been happily practicing under for the last 15 years, I guess it's been. Many years of successful regulation under the Department of Health, rules of conduct, but basically it's a freedom approach, which the legislature decided was appropriate for these practitioners. And so to come in today and say no, half of them, maybe more than half of them, need a new layer of regulation is a departure from what the legislature came to in year 2000. It was signed into law by Governor Ventura. So we're here to talk about numbers, and that's fine with me. Let's talk about some numbers here. This is the fiscal notes, and the estimate is that this may affect eventually 1,500 practitioners, about half of the ones currently enjoying practice under 146A, but the claim is that 700 will register in the first year, and then 200 the next year, and 200 the next year. Well, nobody knows is the honest assessment. Nobody knows. But then you can, to talk about it, you look behind those numbers and say, how does this look to massage therapists, for example, who are practicing now, and will they register? Will they be moved to register and be part of that number that we multiply the fee by? And there are some daunting things for these massage therapists. Remember, they don't even make as much as state legislators do. They might make half of what you honorable reps make. They are not rich people, and the fees make a difference to them. So I talked to one named Donna at great length yesterday on the phone in Rochester. She's a working massage therapist. She really wanted to be here, but she gave me some specific thinking about the numbers. And the daunting thing is many expenses are loaded on top of existing expenses. It doesn't make the state business permits go away. It doesn't make the patchwork of state business permits go away. And so they still have a patchwork, even if this bill is enacted, and they have exam costs that they would have to look at. They would have, some would have educational requirements and continuing education requirements connected to the exams. So we have big businesses emerging in this industry at the national level, mostly. And the exam business is big. The textbook business, the insurance business is big. There are all sorts of interests here, and nothing wrong with having business interests. But realize that, you know, there are possibly special interests, people in the industry who would benefit and others who would lose. So we have to be a little bit aware of that. And the massage therapists themselves may say, as this one that I talked to, Donna, I would not register, and the number one reason is the money. You know, I can't afford this. I don't want to go down this path. And I think many are expressing the same thing. And they're saying, you know, this number of who will register is probably very bloated, and maybe there's 50, mostly in the metro area, who think it would help them because they are worried about the patchwork of state, of local government regulation. That is a real issue. And she's concerned about that. She understands that issue. She thinks it particularly would not be attractive to a massage therapist in greater Minnesota. She says, hey, you know, they have one location. They're probably practicing out of their home, greater Minnesota. They don't need this. They're not going to want to do this. So, you know, I don't have the number to multiply by the fees to get the revenue, but this could be grossly overstated revenue, and the expenses are relatively fixed. So, and she said maybe 250 will leave the field because of the pressures of the fees and the competition and the requirements. And if cities, if municipalities require registration, which there's nothing in this bill that says it won't happen, this could really happen. And this has not been addressed by any committee so far. Then, you know what may happen? Many of them may go and practice underground. They'll say, I'm just going to become invisible. I'm going to practice with some clients that know me well, and they'll be cool. We'll practice underground. I'm not even going to pay those city permit fees anymore. Not going to get into any of this stuff. Maybe practice under 146A, but... And guess what she said then? Knocked my socks off. She said, and that will increase prostitution. When a great many practitioners are driven underground, that will increase prostitution. It would be so ironic if this bill ended up with these unintended effects, including practicing underground. Many more may practice underground if this is required by the cities than would be registered. Not at all what I think any of us want to happen. So I will stop here. I agree with Diane Miller and Ann's testimony, and I won't repeat their points. But I just wanted to give you a perspective that's coming from the actual therapist. And the body workers are even more unlikely to register. They're very diverse. Some of them are doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that. They fall under the category of body workers. They're not going to want to register, trust me. You know, there's a lot of things out of kilter. Looking at the numbers and talking about the numbers is a great opportunity to look a little deeper at what is going on here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It being just 2 minutes left to 2:30, we are going to have to come back this evening.
I can be very brief.
Well, we are going to wrap up. So we're going to come back at 7 o'clock. So we are in recess until 7. All right, the committee will come back to order. We are on House File 644, Representative Zerwas, testifiers. And I believe we had completed Mr. Cashman's testimony, and I believe that's where we're up. Would the next testifier like to come down, and we can continue. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I am Barbara York. I'm a practitioner as well as the president of a state organization of massage therapists and body workers. We oppose this bill, as we have over the many years, because it does not meet the needs of the consumers or the practitioners. It meets the needs of a few people who have always come to this table asking to be exclusively set apart. It's never been about consumer harm. There's never been testimony from consumers. On the fiscal note, you'll notice on page 11 of the 17 pages on the last paragraph, though this is projected to be starting out with 700 people, they also note that they are unable to project the number of massage and bodywork therapists who would become registered under this bill. And on page 17 of 17, under the long-term fiscal considerations, you'll see that the fee levels established in this bill do not fully support the costs described in this fiscal note. This would create a little over $600,000 in state government's deficit in the special revenue fund. So we're setting up something that's going to cost us money that is not called for and harms practitioners, especially in the long run. We know where this goes in other states. It comes in as voluntary, ends up being mandatory. The people who profit are the people who are here as proponents, the owners of schools, the owners of special insurance, and the citizens and the practitioners suffer for it. Some of them will go out of business. Some of them will be hard-pressed to meet some of these requirements. And for myself, as a Jin Shin Jitsu practitioner, I am lumped in as a body worker. But what my work is based on is the major religions of the world, and it's more about touch in the sense of praying. But I would have to meet the requirements in this bill to continue a practice that is time-honored, that is long in cultures. It's based for us here in America on Matthew 16:18 that says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom, and what you loose on earth, I will loose in heaven. It says this in several different places, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and in Revelations. I don't know if the nursing board is going to be able to tell if I'm competent with this, because there is no competency test for that. It's about the rapport that you have with the individual person. And yet I would be required, on my fiscal note, to meet this, and it's way beyond what I can actually afford or would want to afford. I've been practicing since 1981. I could teach some of the classes that are being taught now. I don't need continuing education of a certain set. I would rather go to a seminary class than go to a board of nursing class, because it's going to meet more of the needs that I have with my clients. And yet, this becomes mandatory in a city that says, this is how it's got to be. It's going to affect me, because it's going to take my $50 from the city and make that $500 through the state. And I have done no harm in all this time. And I am well educated in my field. I have thousands of hours of primary education and continuing education. It's true of many of our people. And we design our work around what our people need, our consumers. So I ask you to vote no against this. It costs us in so many ways and of little benefit to the consumer. They come to us by word of mouth, not by what we claim we are, but by referral. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. York. Next up, we have Jessica Rollmilt. Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. And if you could kind of speak into the microphone, or if you could just move it as close to you as you can, it'll sound better over the microphones. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Rompelt. I'm a massage therapist. I have been practicing for over 10 years now and a business owner for 6. I came here today to let you know I oppose this bill. I want you to understand that as a small business owner, there are many expenses, and with more added annual fees plus education requirements that we don't know what those costs will be at this time, it will hurt my business and my ability to practice. The idea of our education being funneled, because it is such a broad spectrum when you're saying body work, like was shared earlier, I will choose the education based on the clientele that I have to better serve them. And my fear with this is our education then will be very funneled and limited to what we're told is accepted. And I want you to understand that as a therapist, everybody asks me, are you full-time? That looks very different from each practitioner. Certain people can only do 6 or 8 a week, which may seem really small for you, but we don't do an 8-hour day. Working on 8 people in one day is next to impossible. Nobody can do that, at least for a long time. The average lifespan of a massage therapist is 2 years. So to be doing this 10 years and have the physical ability to still do it and work on people is a feat. And so there is a natural weeding out before it was heard that, you know, you're trying to protect against, I know this is financial, but you're trying to protect against this patchwork of sex trafficking and prostitution. Will that, I'm not going off course. So I just ask you today vote no, and thank you for listening.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rohmhilt. Next we have Mary Jo Majors.
They had to go back to Rochester. They were here all day.
There's some others that have signed up. Carol Cossey. Nancy Hone? Honey? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, Ms. Hone.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Hone. I'm the traditional naturopath through which I did a lot of body work for 15 years as part of my practice. I appreciated her testimony that you can't do that many if you're a real healer in a day. I'm also a registered nurse in St. Paul. I'm a co-founder of the Minnesota Natural Health Coalition and the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project that worked in the late 90s to pass a bill called Minnesota Statute 146A, which is the Complementary and Alternative Freedom of Access Act. This statute gave citizens access to all of their healers, and it protected the public. It passed with only one dissenting vote in the Senate. The legislators were understood that this protected the public. The practitioners' complaints go to the health department. Earlier, Representative Zerwas mentioned that the police were going to be here, but he couldn't come. Well, no state in the United States that has a law that has licensure for massage or registration for massage has changed the level of prostitution. So that is very important. Also, this fiscal note of almost $630,000 in 5 years is something this committee should be interested in. many municipalities are situated right now to drop this bill right into their city laws to say it will be mandatory. So to say that it's voluntary is an illusion and a veil. Healers will be put out of business. They'll go underground. We don't know these numbers that are fictitionally put in there that will produce revenue for the state. It's a lose. We don't have that kind of money anymore in Minnesota. So many things are needed other than this. I'm sure you want to keep your taxpayers paying taxes, and I'm sure you want to have them continue to work. These are usually women who work part-time, many of them out of their home, adding to their family incomes. And so to put these people out of work when the cities make it mandatory is inappropriate. I also want to say that book learning does not a healer make. Okay, so when we say in all the hearings, they say, well, it's time that this is a profession. You know, professions make their own professions. In states, laws of licensure and registration are to protect the public. The public is already protected with Minnesota Statute 146A. I ask that you vote no on this bill, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. All right. Any other testifiers? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Melissa Ross, and I work in Eagan. I've been a therapist for 6 years, and I've had a business in Eagan for 5 years. I'm here to oppose the bill. I feel the bill will be a financial burden to therapists, and if they are to pay licensing fees to the state, they also have the licensing fees for the local establishment as well. Additional education requirements will also cost therapists hundreds of dollars each year, and many new therapists cannot pay their student loans, let alone continuing education. Some of the starting wages out in the massage world today are $15 to $17 an hour. As a business owner, my income as a business owner is higher, but new therapists are making $15 to $17 an hour plus tips. These wages are not enough to have businesses and therapists to afford the fees that they're imposing on therapists in this bill. I hope you oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ross. And if you check in with the committee page over there, we can get your name and address for the minutes. Thank you so much. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify for or against the bill? All right, seeing none, we now go to the amendments. We have several amendments in the packet, and there are four amendments that I see. Representative Liebling, I have you down as the 11-1.
Mr. Chair, they're all mine, and if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to start with the 12-1.
All right, 12-1, Liebling. Representative Liebling, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to move the 12-1. So members, a lot of what you've heard today is the concern of the small practitioners that the bill is not really a voluntary system. And the reason that it may not be a voluntary system is that once the bill would be enacted into law, there's a great concern that the municipalities would say, okay, now we're only going to allow registered practitioners to operate within our borders. And they're also concerned that those same cities would try to enact, either they would do that or they would try to pass some kinds of educational standards within the borders to say that, you know, you can't be a massage therapist unless you have some certain number of hours of training or something like that. And you've heard from the people who have testified today that we already have in Minnesota a very good regulatory scheme, if you will, under Chapter 146A. So the whole array of different kinds of practitioners, alternative and complementary practitioners, some of whom are massage therapists, some of whom do what they would call body work, and others who do other kinds of healing practices. They're all regulated under Chapter 146A. So we have something in place that seems to have worked pretty well. I've never heard a single complaint, I don't know if any of you have, that 146A isn't working. But now Representative Zerwas's bill is here to say that some of these practitioners should be registered separately. And the other 146A practitioners, many of them are here, they don't want any part of it. They want to continue practicing as they always have. They are the smallest of small businesses. And in this legislature, I think that there's probably not a one of us who doesn't say that we support small businesses. And you've heard from some of them today. And there were a couple of others that came up from Rochester that couldn't stick around. And again, they're small. They are the smallest of small businesses. So what this amendment does is it assures us and them that this is indeed a voluntary bill, that the registration would not be required by any municipality. In other words, that they would, that the people who choose not to register would not be fenced out by this bill, and that the municipalities would not then also add or instead add educational requirements to them, which I think you've heard from people who've testified today that the educational, there is no educational standard, that different people come by their skill and knowledge in different ways. Also, I think that practices that some of these people engage in, some of us might not even really agree that those are healthcare practices. Some of us would. But this is about choice. This is about the choice of the practitioners, and it's about the choice of the patients. It's about allowing individual freedom to practice as long as the public interest is protected. So that's what this amendment is doing. Members, I think it's extremely important. I'd like to ask for a roll call on this amendment, Mr. Chair.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
Because I think this bill could go through and with some modifications, and it could satisfy the needs of the people who have testified today. But I think it's really important for all of us to show our constituents that we indeed are standing up for our small businesses and making sure that this registration, when it says it's voluntary, that it truly is voluntary and that nobody is being fenced out.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to oppose the A12-1 amendment and ask members to vote no. The amendment not only prohibits municipalities from requiring that states do this, our cities do this, but the League has serious concerns with this amendment. I think we have someone from the League that would be available to provide some brief testimony in opposition to the A12-1.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ann Lindstrom. I'm from the League of Minnesota Cities. I think, as you know, we have testified in support of the bill as written as it's moved through the process. As you all know, it's been a long time coming, and it's compromised language that we've agreed to. We are opposed to this. One thing that I want to point out is that, you know, regarding the elimination, or so item C, saying the municipality shall not enact regulations regarding educational standards, things like that, our cities are already doing that within their ordinances. We have a city clerk here from the city of Blaine who could speak directly to what the requirements are of their ordinance. But in this conversation about 146A, the way I understand 146A is that it put in place a structure and a process for somebody to issue complaints with the Department of Health and then the Department of Health to investigate. And in order to regulate the businesses that are happening within cities, they put structures and requirements in place. There are requirements for insurance policies. There are requirements for education. There are requirements for completing a criminal background check. So within this bill, if an individual practitioner registers with the state or compromise the cities, is to then cede regulation to the state so that they can move from city to city without having to comply with the individual requirements within the city. So given all of that, we are opposed, with all due respect, to this amendment.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lindstrom, if I am understanding you correctly, if the bill became law with the educational standards that are described in the bill, you're saying your testimony is that the cities, the municipalities would then yield to the law, the state law that's in place, and would not go beyond that in terms of educational requirements, municipality by municipality. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, for the individual practitioners who register with the state, for those who choose not to, that could be the status quo of the way the city is currently regulating them, and then they still retain the authority to have their business licenses.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ross.
There's a really good point made there, and I want to make sure people understand that currently today, cities require, some cities in their municipal licensure process of an individual practitioner require an education requirement be met. If this amendment were to go through, those individuals that were not registered through the state wanted to keep practicing how they were, suddenly the city of Blaine and other cities would not be able, they would loosen their municipal licensure regulations that are already in effect today in current law. It would take away cities' chances to regulate non-registered practitioners, folks that just want to practice in one city, and it would, so you're taking control away from cities that today already have educational requirements in many, many instances. And as the testifier mentioned, we do have a city clerk here in Blaine that can talk about what some of those educational requirements look like.
Other questions? Oh, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to hear from that person. But, Mr. Chair, I would like to incorporate a one-word change into my amendment. I'd like to, on line 1.7, after the word requiring, I'd like to insert the word additional. And I think that that would take care of what Representative Zerwas has just said, that he's saying that this amendment would take away current standards. And if we put the word additional in there, I think that that would just say that they couldn't enact anything that isn't already in place.
All right. Representative Zerwas.
We'll oppose the amendment.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Explain this to me again. So you're saying that you don't want to impose any limits on the municipalities because they already have, they're regulating unlicensed. But the way I see it is if you enact the registration requirements without placing limits on it, then you have an extra additional burden that it just becomes this layered sort of where you've got the state regulating and you've got the municipalities regulating. They can have their own permit requirements, license requirements, and then we're going to impose registration requirements on top of that. So I'm not seeing where this argument about this patchwork thing that it's valid.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ross.
So the concern is, in this, with this amendment, the concern is that this language would inhibit cities from regulating non-registered therapists that do not register with the state like they currently already do. So it would be taking away a tool from the toolbox that cities today currently have. And since we think that there will be a large group of practitioners that do not choose voluntary registration, the last thing we want to do is tell cities, well, for this group of practitioners that don't voluntary register, you cannot regulate those folks as you have been throughout. So the last thing we want to do is weaken ordinances for the cities.
Representative Allen?
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. With that,
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Maybe the city clerk.
Well,
Representative Leland wanted to.
Yeah, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. Kathy Sorensen, city clerk for the city of Blaine. And I'm just here to respond to some of the concerns. The city of Blaine enacted its ordinance in 2012. And in that ordinance included requirements for education. We require 500 hours of education from an accredited association in order to practice in our city. I also was the clerk for Coon Rapids, and it was a very similar ordinance as well. And firsthand, I can see where massage therapists will come from Coon Rapids and want to practice in Blaine as well. And they're doing the exact same thing that they did right across the border. They're showing the accredited information. They're approving their certificates. They are submitting to another background check again, the exact kind of thing. So that's why this bill would be so good, because of statewide registration, voluntary, and that is fine. They wouldn't have to do those repeated steps between city and city.
And if you wouldn't mind, just, you've got experience with a couple of cities, just, can you just talk generally about how this is affecting cities and if you know the effect to which it's having on suburban areas versus greater Minnesota, or if you could.
Yeah, absolutely, Chair members. It's very labor-intensive for cities to do this. And again, it's very costly for the therapists to go through all of these steps to do the background checks repeated. We put the ordinance in place to help protect the public. To make sure that folks that were practicing in our cities were trained and understood what they were doing. Yes, it's a tool for law enforcement as well. We know that's not going to take away every piece that law enforcement, but it's just another tool in the toolkit.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the testifier. In the city of Blaine, do you have an ordinance that also deals with perhaps window washers, or vent cleaners, or lawn care, any other carpet cleaners? Do you have any other ordinance that you do background checks and license and bonded insurance and all that other stuff that you do with the massage therapist?
Chair, Representative, we have a licensure for solicitors and peddlers for folks that go door to door. So we will do a background check for that and do a fee for depending on how long they want to be in the city. We don't do business licenses for those types of businesses. We license, obviously, some tobacco, some alcoholic beverages, those kinds of things. Background checks are included there as well. But for those types of businesses, no, we do not license those.
Mr. Chair, so if I lived in Blaine, I could have a business to come in and do my windows. They wouldn't have to have it. There's no ordinance against that, or have them insured or background check, or someone to clean my air ducts or clean my carpets. There's no restrictions or no ordinance that prohibits them from doing that, or at least having the insurance and or a background check and such. I just wanted to reiterate that.
Sure, Chair. Yes, Representative. No, we do not have that type of licensure in the city of Blaine.
And just lastly, and I know this issue has been around for a long time, and being a former mayor of Delano, I don't think that we ever had an ordinance that prohibited or did background checks for massage therapists. Maybe they do now, but I certainly not when I was there. Why do you do that?
Ms. Torrance.
Chair, Representative, we do that, again, as a way to protect the public. It's a business that obviously is very personal. There's some exposure there for the public, and we needed to come up with a solution, some ordinances, just to put some parameters around it. I obviously would be up to our city council if this law did pass, whether the council would make the voluntary registration a mandatory part of our city code. We don't anticipate that. So we would still allow non-registered massage therapists to work and practice in the city of Blaine, but they would follow the ordinances that are already in place right now. So that would not change for any of the non-registered therapists.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McFadden.
And then to protect the public from what?
Ms. Torrance.
Chair, representative from from practice that may not, to ensure that the therapists are educated and are practicing correctly, as well as compliance checks with our business licenses to help with some of the potential sex trafficking that could occur.
All right.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to the testifier, since you've been doing this, have this educational requirement, do you have an educational requirement for people who do healing touch and other kinds of, I guess what I really want to know is how do you define massage for this 500 hours that you require?
Chair,
Representative,
the 500 hours is part of a coursework in massage therapy. Currently, the City of Blaine does not license healing type practices. We do have exceptions in our ordinance for folks that may practice under direction of a doctor, podiatrist, chiropractor, those types of things. Again, it was another way, it would be another board that could oversee and have a place where complaints, public complaints, could be directed to. Right now, that's not occurring outside of 164 or 146. Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, members, the problem here is that, you know, the problem of people who want to practice in various locations is a real problem. I'm not trying to minimize that. But the issue here is whether the solution for some of those practitioners who granted want a standard way, a centralized way to get a credential that they can use everywhere, that part of it's fine if it's truly voluntary. But I think what you heard the testifier say here is that they could choose to not allow these other practitioners to continue to practice. So if that's the case, if even one municipality would decide that, what we're doing here is saying that you're only a legitimate practitioner for massage therapy and body work, which, by the way, is a pretty broad definition. If you go to certain schools, have a certain kind of education, and the lady who testified here about, I don't know what she called her, Ms. York, who told us about her practice that has a spiritual element to it, if the City of Blaine decided that that was massage, I think she's doing some kind of touch, if the city decided that was massage, she would be stopped from practicing unless she went and did this massage therapy package thing that is in this bill. So that's why this is an important amendment. And all it does is it stops them from putting on, you know, the first part of it says they can't fence other people out, that they've got to allow people to continue to practice under 146A. And if that's not the case, I don't know why we don't just repeal the whole darn thing. I don't hear anybody wanting to do that. And then the second piece of this is that they shouldn't enact additional educational standards. And I don't know why municipalities would really be the right place to enact educational standards for all these different practitioners. And I'm not sure that we should be doing that. 146A has worked very well. So the prostitution issue is one thing, and I am not against having everybody get a background check. I am not against having that be centralized, but this bill goes much further than that, and I think we need this amendment to make sure that it doesn't go a lot further than it claims to be going. So yes. That's the amendment.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it sounds like a lot of the discussions around 146A, and could we simply exclude 146A from this? Would that solve the problems? I guess that's a question to the author.
Representative Zerwas.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, there is an amendment that Representative Liebling will be offering that goes a long ways towards carving out folks that operate under 146A that are not massage therapists, that I think should provide a lot of comfort to folks. So, and that's an amendment that we'll be discussing in a little bit. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Zerwas.
Just real briefly, one of the things that Representative Liebling said is factually inaccurate. And the reality is, someone that's practicing with healing touch, he said, with this bill, if someone was practicing healing touch and this bill were to pass and Blaine considered that, and the city of Blaine considered that massage, then they would be unable to practice the educational requirements. The reality is that today in Blaine, through their city ordinance, they have educational requirements. And so if that determination was made today, that would not be allowed. So this law, this bill, would not impact that. And what we are trying to say, and why we don't approve, why do we not support this amendment, is that the last thing I want to do as we push forward is take away a city's autonomy to continue practicing the way they have. Many cities have massage therapy ordinances that they've written in conjunction with the League of Minnesota Cities, in cooperation with the Minnesota Police Chiefs, that say you can define your requirements for a municipal license. If someone does not want to go to voluntary registration but would like to go to municipal licensure instead, we can't disarm the cities from enacting their ordinances.
Representative Halvers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this discussion around this amendment, I think I need some clarification because I'm looking at the bill and I'm looking at 146A. And so perhaps the author can help or someone else. So I'm with regard to the bill, Representative Zerwas, it looks to me like people have talked about this as being very vague, but it looks to me that there are very specific things that one does in the definition of massage and body work therapy, and the list seems pretty extensive. There's also a very extensive list of what is not included in massage and body work therapy. And when I look over at 146A, the number of practices that are considered complementary and alternative are quite big. It's a big list. And the only piece that is listed that we're talking about in 146A is body work, massage, and massage therapy, which is then defined in your bill. And so if 146A stays in place, it feels like those alternative and complementary practitioners are still regulated under 146A, and their regulation doesn't change, unless I'm reading this wrong. Can you help me?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Alderson, you're spot on. There is another amendment that Representative Liebling will be offering, the A13, which is the belt and suspenders and cummerbund amendment, that says we really, really mean it this time. But you're spot on.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Halverson, the issue with this amendment is really whether they can say that if you're not registered under this bill, that you wouldn't be able to practice in my city. Because you're still, if you choose not to register, if this is truly a voluntary bill, then you can still be a massage therapist without registering under 146A, where massage and massage therapy and body work practitioners are under 146A. So you could continue your practice as you always have, meeting whatever city ordinances are in place. I mean, some require business license and other kinds of things, which I assume they still will if people are registered or not registered. All this says is that truly this is voluntary. so that you're not going to lose your business as a massage therapist. I think I kind of pulled people off a little bit with that, you know, into the other definitions, you know. But all this amendment is doing is saying that just because you're not registered under the bill does not give the cities, doesn't mean the cities now can fence you out and say you can't work or add additional, because I've changed it, add additional educational requirements to you.
Mr. Chair.
That's what it does. And the next one, by the way, has just the first part and not the second part.
Representative Zerwas.
Because we believe that cities should be able to enforce their ordinances and issue municipal license to folks that choose not to register in the manner that they have, that if they're doing currently and would want to continue in the future, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, and I would oppose this amendment.
All right. Well, seeing no further discussion, we're going to vote on the Liebling A12-1 amendment as amended with the word additional preceding the word educational in line 1.7. We'll just vote on that as incorporated, even though we didn't take a formal vote on that. So the clerk will take the roll on the amendment.
Chair Dean.
Nope.
Vice Chair McDonald.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
No.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Backer.
Nope.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Mack. Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Purcell. Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Schoen.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
There being 13, or there being 3 ayes and 13 nays, the amendment is not adopted. All right. The next one. Representative Liebling, which would you like to take?
The A11, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Liebling moves the A11 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like a roll call on this one as well.
Roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Liebling, to your amendment.
So, members, this is really the same thing, except it doesn't deal with the education requirements. So this is getting down to the nitty-gritty of what this is about. If this is really a voluntary bill and it's not meant to fence out people who don't choose to register, then you should be voting for this amendment. This amendment is for your small businesses who want to be able to practice without going through, jumping through the hoops and being told by the state that they need certain kind of education requirement, that they're going to be under the Board of Nursing and all of the other stuff, and to allow them to continue to practice freely under 146A as they are, and under the same, you know, the cities are still free to have their business license or their safety inspections or whatever they do for everybody else, but they would not be able to decide that somebody who wasn't registered with the state under this bill was not allowed to practice anymore in their community. And I think this goes to the core of the thing that really terrifies the people who are so opposed to this bill, who, I don't know about you, but I've gotten lots and lots of emails from all over the state on this issue, and this is the core of their concern.
All right. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, in speaking with the League opposes this amendment and will oppose the bill. If it's adopted, I ask for a no vote.
All right. Further discussion to the A11 amendment. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the A11.
Chair Dean.
Nope.
Vice Chair McDonald.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
No.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Mack. Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Purcell. Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Schoen.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
There being 3 ayes and 13 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Representative Liebling, which would you like to take next?
The A13, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling moves the A13 amendment. Representative Liebling, to your amendment.
So, members, this is, as Representative Zerwas has already discussed, this is an amendment that just assures the 146A practitioners that they wouldn't be impacted by the bill. Of course, now we know that they could be impacted by being fenced out by communities, and this, of course, doesn't affect that. But it's basically an amendment that is basically says there aren't any unintended consequences from this in terms of spilling over to affect definitions in 146A and things like that. So I think this is kind of what Representative Hamilton was looking for.
All right. Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Representative Leland. This goes a long way to clarify the position of the bill that this does not impact others, practitioners under 146A, and we'll accept this amendment as a friendly amendment.
All right. Further discussion to the A13 amendment. All right. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adoption of the A13 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A13 amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling to the A14.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the A14 is a different issue, and that is that under this bill, the regulation is under the Board of Nursing, and Chapter 146A is under the Commissioner of Health. So I wanted to see if we could get the Board of Nursing and or the Commissioner of Health, somebody from MDH, to talk to us about why, or maybe Representative Zerwas can talk to us about why this is under the Board of Nursing, because the an amendment that we adopted earlier in the day that Representative Zerwas brought was one that was meant to sort of streamline the sharing of information between the Board of Nursing and the Department of Health, and it just seemed to me that it's rather unusual and probably unnecessary to put this under the Board of Nursing. And you've heard some of the testifiers today say that, you know, they feel uncomfortable with that. So I just wanted to use this amendment to maybe have a bit of a discussion about why we're doing that in the bill. And of course, we see that we have a pretty big fiscal note as a result of that decision as well. So do we have somebody here who's from the Board of Nursing who could speak to this?
Representative Zerwas, do you know of anyone who's in the audience who might be able to answer those questions, or if you can, to the best of your ability?
I don't think we have someone from. You want to? I think we do have a testifier that might be able to give some insight on how we ended up here, but I do not believe there's someone from the Board of Nursing.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Susan Tejan. I'm with the American Massage Therapy Association. I'm the Government Relations Chair. And no, I'm not with the Board of Nursing. But speaking to the question about why the Board of Nursing is involved in our bill is, for a regulatory body, we needed to go to an existing board for the state. We're not going to create, at the expense of creating a whole new board for massage therapy would be fiscally irresponsible at this point, I believe, and that's why we're working on this model. Looking at the existing boards available to us, we found that the Board of Nursing was philosophically most closely aligned with massage therapy. Additionally, there are many nurses that are also massage therapists. I don't know if you want me to continue to expound on that, but that's the fundamentals.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
I think we do have someone from...
Yeah, I believe we have Ms. Finnegan from MDH.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Melissa Finnegan, and I'm the Director of Legislative Relations for the Department of Health. This bill and the advocates, Representative Zerwas, decided to go with the Board of Nursing for the regulatory authority on this bill. To my knowledge, we were not asked to be the regulatory authority, and as an agency, we leave it up to Representative Zerwas and the committee which authority they want to have on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Finnegan. And could you just describe the relationship between practitioners and their overseeing boards and who they pay their licenses to? So if there's a barber has a license through the board of barber, whatever we have.
Barbering.
whatever they do. They write out their checks and they get them sent back. How is this unusual, the relationship that is being proposed here, or how does it compare to other similar or similar professions?
Mr. Chair, I would not presume to speak for the Board of Nursing on how this relates to their usual relationships. I know for entities that are licensed by the Department of Health, it is typically that they pay their licensing fees to us, which then offsets the cost of having that licensing program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Liebling, and I met briefly yesterday afternoon when we went over these amendments. I think this might be possible, but my concern is, without knowing the impacts at this late stage, I don't want to get 3 feet short of the finish line and have the wheels come off. One of the requests we've made as of today is to see if we can generate a fiscal note or an estimate on this amendment to see the impact of the department. But without that information and with it being so late in the session, I would be uncomfortable with this amendment today and would ask Representative Liebling if she'd be willing to withdraw the amendment for today. And let's see if we can get some numbers and figure out if this is viable.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm really disappointed that the Board of Nursing doesn't have anybody here, and because I really think that we need to hear from them and understand from what I've been told, maybe Representative Zerwas can speak to this, that they're not really so excited about this, I gather. I don't know if you've had, Representative Zerwas, have you had discussions with the Board of Nursing about this, and you know, what have they said to you about whether they feel like this is something they want to do?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chairman, members, nobody, to be clear, nobody from the Board of Nursing has contacted me and opposed this. Nobody from the Board of Nursing has contacted me and asked me to change the bill in any way to have this not go to the Board of Nursing. I looked at the fiscal note and said, they might not be that excited about this. That's the extent of what I inferred out of the number on the fiscal note. But nobody, certainly nobody from the Board of Nursing has contacted me or anyone else that I know of to say that they're opposed to this bill or opposed to this being placed, this advisory group to be placed under the Board of Nursing.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Well, I think it's troubling that, you know, if this bill is giving a whole new set of responsibilities to the Board of Nursing, and yet they haven't come forward and had a discussion with you about it. I think that is problematic. I hope that you can, if this goes forward, I hope that you can work that out. But I will withdraw the amendment.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Representative Liebling.
All right. I think that concludes all of the amendments for House File 644. Further discussion to the bill. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This whole process here is familiar to the bill I brought, I think it was last year, on healthcare interpreters bill. And if anybody remember, it was very similar. I think we had many practitioners that came to strongly oppose it, and I think it was they probably filled up the entire site over there. And I think if it hadn't been the late hour, maybe there would have been more here to oppose it. But so in that case, we tabled the bill because it wasn't ready, because we hadn't really looked at all the impacts that the bill would have on employment, on wages, on low-income communities, new immigrants. And then so what happened was MDH stepped up, and then during the interim they did community meetings, they did a survey, they had comment period, and so they came up with a whole tiered sort of approach. And right, and Representative Hamilton, very, very good approach and very thoughtful process, and people thought they were included. So when it came time for Representative Hamilton to present the bill, there was, people were probably still concerned, but they weren't opposing it. They were like saying, okay, this has to be done, let's work together and we move forward this. And we don't have that here. And I think that we rush sometimes with these licensing bills, and this one's easy to do because it's a different type of with the, unlike other professions, they're not associated with with the sex trafficking and the prostitution, and so you have law. So it really, whose interest is this bill benefiting? And so you can talk about special interests, supply and demand. You can talk about money interests, the larger employers, the corporations. You can talk about police have an interest in it, but under our statute to regulate a profession, there has to be harm to the public, and that and we look at whether that can be redressed in some other manner. And in most states that have these registration, voluntary or otherwise, it hasn't had an impact on reducing unlicensed those that are engaging in illegal activities, because there isn't resources often to figure out who's not licensed, and so it's usually just handled as a police matter. And in this state, we've put $7 million into sex trafficking and hundreds of thousands into training police and the general public to recognize sex trafficking and then treat those that are, as victims and in need of protection. One of the testifiers tried to say that this really has, they're separate issues, and so we should not really change the way that we evaluate whether this registration is really is necessary to protect the public from harm. And so the Obama administration came out with a 75-page report cautioning and encouraging states to really look at the impacts of registration and licensing on low-income wage earners. And so does it, we have such huge wage gaps in many of these professions where they're part-time and where, and especially impacting women. If we could take more time and look and get input from, is this going to impact? It may be turned out that it's actually, it might increase wages. In some professions, it has. But you don't have that evidence yet. You don't. And so to tie this into, that
You know, it's a lot of like, we don't want this in our backyard, we don't want this in our community, and so we need to make sure that you know, that it's not in our backyard. And because it's because of that association, when that's not, you know, that's a very, very small percentage of the profession of the that are using the cover of this to engage in illegal activity, and so the other ones shouldn't have to, you know, and that's often the problem with this is that it's counterproductive, and that it fences people out, and that it puts a burden on low income entry into this profession. And so all those things need to be taken into account, and so that we have some, I mean, $185 to annual license is huge for somebody that's only doing this, if, you know, 10 hours a week to make extra income to supplement their wages. So I would encourage you to table this and to engage in the same kind of process that your colleague, Representative Hamilton, engaged in, and I think it would be a much better outcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. And Ms. Aves has caught something in the bill that we need to correct before we go on to further comments on the bill. Ms. Aves has said that the section related to lines 15.4 and 15.5 are no longer in the bill, so these lines need to be deleted. Is that correct, Ms. Aves?
That's correct, Mr. Chair and members.
Oh, okay.
The amendment instruction would be on page 15, delete lines 4 and 5.
All right. On page 15, deletion lines 4 and 5, any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Amendment is adopted. Further questions or comments to the bill? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, this bill, you know, there are problems that are real problems that this bill is attempting to solve. One of them we know is that some practitioners or businesses, in particular Massage Envy is one we heard about, but there may be others that want to practice in different places and have to face a bunch of different requirements across municipalities. So that is a real problem. This bill is attempting to solve that problem. There's also perhaps a prostitution issue that this bill might be attempting to solve, although it's not clear. I certainly haven't heard anything, and people have been telling me that there's no evidence that having any kind of educational requirements helps to deal with the prostitution issue. But my problem with this bill is that those two issues are being used to bootstrap other things into law. And in particular, that is requiring certain kind of education and a certain number of hours of education and requiring this extra layer of regulation for some massage therapists. Now, this bill's been all along, it's been promoted as being voluntary. What's the problem? It's voluntary. Well, now we know from what happened in this committee, from the opposition of the League of Minnesota Cities, this is not voluntary. For some massage therapists, this bill, as it is written now, is going to force them to register. And I don't know how anyone can deny that after what we heard today. Because any municipality now, they made it very clear they oppose that amendment because they want the option of being able to say you must register with the state. So this is not a voluntary bill. A couple of problems should be solved. They can be solved in other ways. There's no problem with requiring a criminal background check. I'm sure none of these 146A practitioners would probably object to having a, I shouldn't speak for them, but I'm guessing that they wouldn't object to going to the state and having a card that says I had a criminal background check. That's not the problem. And I think that there's a way to fix this problem of working in different municipalities with different requirements. That's what the bill said it was going to do. But it does much more than that. And it's the much more than that is really the problem here. So, members, I'm going to urge you to oppose this bill. I think that a lot of your constituents may not be aware that this is happening, but I think if you were to go back to your constituents and tell them all that you did this, that you potentially made it so that cities could say you can't practice anymore here unless you go through this registration procedure, I think they might not be so happy about that. And as Representative Allen said very well, we don't know the impacts that that could have on a lot of these small businesses. Most of the people who testified today were women. A lot of them are doing this very part-time. They don't want to jump through all these hoops, and they haven't done anything wrong, and they shouldn't be required to jump through these hoops. So I urge you to oppose this bill, and if this bill does get to the floor, I think it's going to be a long one, Representative Zerwas. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Further discussion to the bill? We are on the bill. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Zerwas, any closing comments on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief.
Thank you.
That was brief.
It's only 10 after 8. We have 4 more on.
That was brief. Just a couple thoughts. This bill is designed to be not a fencing bill, but the idea of making it easier to practice between communities. Right now, what we have is we have each city with a fence around each city with separate requirements. You heard from a city clerk that said they already have education requirements in the city of Blaine, in the city of Coon Rapids, in many, many other cities. So that is not new. That is not scary. That is not terrifying. That's current city ordinance. Someone made the comment that this is moving too fast. There have been iterations or versions of this bill going on at the Capitol since Zubas and Zima were popular. So the idea that this is somehow new or screeching towards the finish line at lightning speed is not an accurate portrayal of how this has come through. And the reality is, members, is the idea that current patchwork systems in some systems, in some communities that don't have any regulation at all, or have very little regulation, that is a serious issue and a concern. I believe that's why the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association support the bill. I think that's why the League of Minnesota Cities support the bill. And so that, I would urge a yes vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas, for the bill. And
Mr.
Representative Schoen.
I want to defend Representative Hamilton Zubas. They're still
thank you for that bipartisan note. And I want to apologize to Representative Liebling's constituents who traveled up earlier to testify for the bill this afternoon. I apologize for that. We should have gotten them up earlier within the committee so that we were recognizing the fact that they had to travel, and we normally try to do that, and I apologize for not doing that. Little frustrated that we are having lots of amendments on a licensing bill. I'm a student of Cy Tao who contended, I think, rightfully so, that if you have one amendment on a licensing bill, you might as well have 15,000. Because at some point the certainty of deadlines has to bring the stakeholders together, or they decide to wait until the next year, and that's always a good incentive for people to get on the same page and to keep us from the amendment. So sorry, Cy, as we go through. All those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
No.
What is the bill number?
644
is referred to Ways and Means as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Sorry for the late night.
Are we adjourned?
Yeah. Are we adjourned?
Another bill.
And
we have another bill.
We're not enough.
We don't.
No,
we're adjourned.